Good evening, everyone. I'm Sally Lewis, and I'm chairperson of the Education Justice Committee at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood. On behalf of the members of the committee, I want to say that we're really delighted to have you here to talk about what is happening in public education and how we can draw together to create the best education for all of our children. Now, a little bit about us. We're a liberal religious organization with a strong belief in the democratic process and the inherent dignity and worth of every individual. We believe in justice and equity and compassion, and these principles have brought us here together tonight. We tend to be an opinionated bunch, but we endeavor to listen to points of view that are different than our own. So we ask you, the audience, to put aside your own beliefs and to honor those of others if they may be different. Those of the moderator, those of the panelists, and those of audience members. With that, I'd like to introduce our moderator, who's put a lot of time and effort into this evening, Dorothy Fiola. Let me tell you about Dorothy. She's worked at William Patterson University for 17 years, and currently is Associate Dean in the College of Education. She served as president of the New Jersey Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, the NJACTE. Dorothy has represented William Patterson on several state committees, task forces related to teacher education and teacher evaluation. Her areas of research include literacy as well as teacher education. With that, I'd like you to welcome Dorothy.
Thank you, everybody. It's very nice to be here this evening. I'd like to thank the Education Justice Committee for inviting me to speak, and certainly Sally for helping me to organize. And the panelists have been very gracious the last few weeks. We've been chatting on the email and by phone to organize the event for you this evening. So I just want to thank everybody for participating. I just have a few opening remarks before I introduce the panelists. What I'd like to say is that we live in interesting times right now. Every day, education is under fire from somewhere. In the media, we've seen it on NBC's Education Nation, films like Waiting for Superman, and a recent issue of Time magazine devoted to bad teachers, all feeding into a frenzy of a crisis in American education. According to Diane Ravitch, an overreliance and misuse of testing and data have created this sense of crisis in public education, which lends credibility to claims that American education is in decline and failing. Public education is in crisis, but only so far as society is, and only so far as this new narrative of crisis has destabilized it. To be sure, there are some political and private entities pushing an agenda with solutions to this perceived crisis. They have money and they have influence. They want more high-stakes testing. They want to close public schools. They support privately funded public charter schools and vouchers. And they are okay with children being taught by minimally prepared teachers. Their rhetoric is couched in democratic language about equity and high-quality education for all children in America, but their reform agenda seems to contradict their language by offering solutions that cut funding to public education and then require that everyone compete for what's left over and race to the top of what I'm not sure. Tonight's panelists use their experience and expertise and give their time to grassroots causes that are taking on some of these irrational fears and behaviors. And they are Deborah Cuernavaca, who is the legislative director for New Jersey Working Families, an organization that works for social and economic equity for all people in New Jersey. As part of her job, she coordinates Better Choices for New Jersey, a broad and diverse coalition of partners that unite to advocate for revenue and funding to the programs and essential social services that our state should provide. Deborah has been a public school activist for many years and has worked previously for Save Our Schools New Jersey and NJEA. She lives in East Brunswick, where her three children attend public school. Deborah is president of the East Brunswick Library Board of Trustees and is on the board of PULSE. She has a PhD in anthropological archaeology. Christine Magui is the mother of two public school children. She became active on school issues in 2010 when she organized SOS Montclair to stop threatened school closures due to state budget cuts. She now advocates for progressive education locally with Montclair Cares About Schools and statewide with SOS New Jersey. Junius Williams is a nationally recognized attorney, musician, educator, and independent thinker who has been at the forefront of the civil rights and human rights movements in the country for decades. His life in the movement in the South and the North has been chronicled in the Civil Rights History Project, a collaborative initiative of the Library of Congress and the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He was the youngest president of the National Bar Association, the oldest and largest organization of black attorneys in the U.S., and was listed as one of the 100 most influential blacks in America in Ebony Magazine. Junius ran for mayor of Newark and now teaches leadership and community organization at Rutgers University, Newark, based on lessons outlined in his new book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power. Sharon Smith is a wife and mother of five children and an organizer. She is co-founder and executive director of PULSE, and since PULSE's inception, Sharon has organized around policy change to ensure that parents and students have a voice in the decision-making process. Jean McTavish is a 28-year veteran educator, and since 2001, she has been the principal of Edward A. Reynolds Westside High School in New York City. Jean has earned degrees in anthropology and education, special education, and is a doctoral candidate in education administration at Teachers College. Jean frequently participates on panels and presents workshops focusing on her school's implementation of the Common Core standards. In addition, Jean's two children attend the Ridgewood Public Schools. Jean is an organizer for United Opt Out and SOS New Jersey, and she works with a variety of other like-minded organizations such as Change the Stakes, Reclaiming the Conversation, and EDU4. We will hear from each panelist about the work they're doing in their communities and then invite the audience to ask questions and have a conversation about our issues and concerns. Junius?
Thank you for that introduction. And I'm very glad to be here. This is my second time coming to Ridgewood. I was telling Helen, I don't know what Ridgewood looks like during the day. But I've been able to find my way around in the dark, so I'm very happy to have learned to navigate. I guess I'm an instrument flyer as opposed to one who navigates by the sun, because I've never seen the sun. So my job is to start us off by kind of setting the tone. I have a group called the Abbott Leadership Institute at Rutgers University. And we've been around now since about 2002. As a matter of fact, three of the four speakers in addition to me have been regular members of the class or from time to time anyway. And so they understand who we are and what we do. We started out with 19 parents and one teacher, and now our classes go up to anywhere from 50 to 75 to 100 people, depending upon how hot the issue is and how interested people are in that temperature. So we have parents now, we have teachers, we have young people who are teenagers, young people who are in college learning to be teachers, and we have what we just call community advocates. And what do we do? We are involved in empowerment, in the empowerment process, in the process of empowering people from a parental perspective, how to get involved in schools and make them better. Now, the outline or the scene that was just described by our moderator is based upon a definition of quote-unquote school reform that has evolved over the last few years. Actually, you could take it way, way back, but we don't have to go back that far. It's the most recent iteration of the far right, and they just happen to now be focused on privatization of schools. But before that, before we had any idea of what was coming to Newark, there were a bunch of us struggling for school reform, real school reform. And I was happy to join that struggle when I came back from living and working in Irvington, where I was town attorney for a while. And I came back and I said, well, we need to put together a group of people who are going to work in the context of the Abbott program, which some of you may know was a result of a decision by the Supreme Court that said urban school districts need to have more resources equal to the best suburban districts, probably like Ridgewood. And there needs to be school reform based upon, among other things, I'm giving you a shortcut version here, parental involvement. So we wanted to make sure that happened. But as time went by, we saw that it was harder to do than we expected. Let me just read a little bit. This was, when you write a book, this book has been out since January, and I've got a few copies here for some people have already bought some, so the rest of you may want to do it as well. But when you write a book and you say, well, the book just came out in January, actually, the book was written now almost 3 years ago. It takes that long to get it ready after you get yourself into a position where you think. So what I found out when I came back to join the struggle to get people involved in school, this is what I had to say. I attract a lot of people who have already been involved in advocacy for better schools. Some people are very good at banging at the door to gain entry for rights they are entitled to have. However, few people understand what they have to do once the door is open and the power structure says, come on in and sit down at the table. Such is the situation with the Abbott case remedies and No Child Left Behind. The advocacy skills are far different at the table than those used in demonstrations, takeovers, and picket lines, as we learned in the medical school fight. That was an urban renewal struggle in Newark. People today are frustrated, confused, and angry because the advocacy process is more complicated than they have learned. People are looking for ways to make the changes they need to have, but tend to repeat the same answers they may have been good then, but are no longer valid. As my friend and protege Lucius Jones says, the fight is in us, but we don't understand the nature of the fight. So the Abbott Leadership Institute was designed to bring people such as you see right here at the table, who all of us come from a different perspective, but we get together and we teach each other and we learn from each other. Everybody up here, I can say I have learned something from, and I hope I have been able to teach as well. So as years have gone by, there's a different set of players, there's a different game. The game was defined by our moderator. So we have had to learn to adjust in the struggle to make sure we can accommodate the people who we want to help, which are the parents and the children and ourselves as people who are interested in not only democracy, but in empowerment. So here's a kind of a formula that all of us have used at one point or another, whether we be in New York, whether we be in Montclair, whether we be in Newark, whether we are all over the state, as Deborah is. One of those things that we've learned collectively is, number one, collect the information about the school policy that is troublesome. Use the information collected to formulate a perception of the problem. Get together with a critical mass of people and share the information and use the information and initial perception to raise questions. Use that information and perception to formulate an appropriate, organized, not individual, but organized response to make schools better in conjunction with other stakeholders, and go out with at least five people and put that response in action. So I think what you're going to hear here today is how people have negotiated that kind of formula in one way or another in different localities at different times, all in the context of this new thing called school reform, which they have visited upon us, pushing and trying to push our definition of what's best for the children to the curb. And with that, I turn it to speaker number Sharon. Sharon Smith from Newark, New Jersey.
Thank you. Thank you, Junis. I said to Dorothy, she said, so Junis is going to go before you, and then you're next. I said, wow, I won't have anything to say when he finishes speaking. But he left some space for me to say some things.
Nice adventure to tell us about.
Oh, yes. So PULSE is Parents Unified for Local School Education. It is an organization that was created by parents and is led by parents, but we also support students. And initially, in 2007, 2008, we began to work on policies that allow parents and students to have input in the decisions of budget, curriculum, and status of their principals. A nice way to say that they make the decision to hire and fire principals. Of course, we were told that it was a little aggressive and that we needed to rethink about the policies, and so we began to write policies that were very similar to hiring, firing the principals, but brought it down a notch. But since the appointment of our state superintendent, Cammy Anderson, in 2011, many of the local school teams have been dismantled, and others are not functioning as governing teams in our local public schools. The fight began with parents fighting for their public schools. And the direction of the policy has changed now, and now we're fighting just to make sure that the schools stay open. In the past 3 years, Superintendent Cammy Anderson has recited, renewed, relocated, and converted to charters at least 20 public schools in Newark. In December 2013, Superintendent Anderson rolled out the One Newark Plan and Universal Enrollment. Both plans had little to no input from community, yet the impact of the plan affects one-third of Newark public school students. Specifically in the South Ward, close to 40,000 residents are impacted by the reorganization plan. There are many concerns for the children and parents of Newark Public School. To name a few, in my opinion, the major concern is that the universal enrollment is presented as an opportunity for parents to have a choice of a school. But yet, that's not the reality. The reality is there's a mere chance that the parents will get the school of choice from the application. And that is why you've been seeing parents on the news and the media fighting for a school for their child because they are not assigned to the school that they originally requested. And most of the time, these schools are across town. One of the problems also is transportation. It's unsafe and callous for the superintendent to think that children from the ages K to eighth grade can travel across the city on their own. And if you know, if you're getting up 6 o'clock in the morning, it's still dark outside. And so these children are 7, 8, 9 years old who are asked to get on a bus, sometimes to get to another bus, which is a hub, to go to another school. And the parent is not allowed to have a ticket or provide money or transportation for the child to travel with the child to school. So the child has to travel on their own. The other thing too is the area that's most heavily hit is the South Ward. And the South Ward has the highest level of single moms. It has the highest level of poverty. And so for these parents to make a consideration to either get on the bus with their child to go to school or to save that money for other responsibilities that they have to take care of for their children. Special needs. Special needs is another area which is not really, first of all, special needs was not an area that Newark Public School was actually effectively taking care of in the first place. But now that this one Newark enrollment is in place, there is less chance for a child with special needs to get a school that they have services in that school. I met a parent last Saturday at an event, and she has a special needs child, and her child's first day of school was October 13th. So all of those days were missing. There was no education, there was no teaching, there was no learning for that child up until October 13th. We still, to this date, have children that are not assigned to a school and that they are home. And it's close to 3,000 to 4,000 students that are not in school at this point. So what we decided is that Pulse has joined alliances in Newark and nationally to fight the corporate reform. In May, we filed a Title VI complaint to investigate the discriminatory practices of the One Newark plan, and the federal government has merited it for investigation. So there's an open investigation on the One Newark plan. We also know that the race to the top money, which was just talked about with Dorothy, has not produced the results that it has intended. The SIG, which is the School Improvement Grant from the U.S. Department of Education, are allotted to states through an application, a process that mostly everyone gets who applies for it, a process to get money that is meant to use to improve most struggling schools in the country. Until now, there are only four models for the state's schools districts could choose from. It's to turn the school over to a charter operator, remove half of the teaching staff and the principal, close the school, or transfer it through a removal of staff but less. According to the USDOE's own data, there has been some, though not very significant, results for these four models. In the spring, after pressure from the national alliance that I belong to, Journey for Justice Alliance, Congress included new language in the federal budget to allow the fifth state determined option. The regulations for the fifth option won't be released until December, but we believe that funding could be used for the new model. And so what we're doing as for Pulse is that we are pushing for our states to use a more holistic approach in making sure that student achievement happen. As I've always said and said in a lot of interviews, that you don't have to smash a system in order to make it work again. That moving a child from one area of town to another does not prove that student achievement would happen. So we are looking forward to making sure that students have an opportunity to stay in their neighborhood schools and still learn without this disruption of education. Thank you.
Good evening. I want to start by thanking everybody for giving up some time on a Friday evening to come here for the organizers, and I'm like so deeply honored to be flanked by this panel. It is such a treat. So I'm excited to be here. I spend a lot of time in a lot of important meetings, but there is really nothing that thrills me more to be able to come out and talk about the work that's going on and the things that are being done and reaching out to people who want to engage and learn, because that's at the core of what's going to be the success of the pushback that you've heard about already. As a backdrop to my comments, which are going to focus a little bit more on school funding and New Jersey-specific budget issues, I want to remind us that there's a law of the land. It's the School Funding Reform Act that was passed in 2008 as a means to fairly fund schools, to provide equity. It was a national model considered one of the most progressive in the nation, and what it did was establish funding that followed the child, regardless of zip code, regardless of where they live, suburb, rural, urban. If a child had additional needs beyond the basic educational needs, they got the funding for the basic needs, and then they got weighted increases in the funding per child. So if you had an IEP, if you were an English language learner, whatever it was that demanded additional funding, the state would work that in. So districts were allotted a certain amount of funding according to this very complex formula that I don't even pretend to parse. They were allotted the money that each child should need, right? So you were following the money, was going where the child needed it. And that's our law of the land. It's not a perfect law. There are changes that people would like to see made. There's adjustments for geographic, for special education, but it was an improvement over what we had, theoretically, if it had worked, if it had been funded, and it is the law. In 2010, the School Funding Reform Act was fully funded with the assistance of a great amount of federal money that came in that year. Not 100% of the districts, but nearly all the districts got what the school funding formula said they should have. And it was complex because it was the rolling in of this plan. So it takes certain different forms of roll in, but it was doing pretty well. And that was until 2010 when we hit the budget cuts. And in the middle of the school year, in the middle of an academic school year and the budget school year, the government here announced that there would be mid-year cuts to every school across the state, virtually, that you would not be getting your last payment of school aid that the state promised you. And that became a downhill, I can't even call it a roller coaster because it hasn't gone back up since, but a downhill spiral, basically, of school funding. Since 2010, the cumulative underfunding of education, according to what the formula would dictate, has been nearly $6 billion, spread unequally across the state, because a percentage of your school aid comes from the state, and a percentage is paid your local fair share based on your property taxes. So as you can imagine, when the state cuts back its funding, the districts that are impacted the most are those districts that rely most heavily on state funding and less on their property taxes. And if we look at what those areas are, the delineation is pretty clear. Urban areas rely more heavily on state aid. Suburban areas with higher property tax bases rely more on their local fair share. Some suburbs get nearly 90% of their school funding from local fair share. Some urban districts get nearly 90% from the state. So while $6 billion across the landscape is a huge amount and it's hurt every school district, I would argue, it has disproportionately impacted urban areas of schools. And there's an excellent report by Journey for Justice, right, called Death by 1,000 Cuts, which is a national study of the peeling away of funding to urban schools and the impact that it's had. The impacts everywhere are increased class sizes, decreased enriched curriculum, many other things, loss of guidance counselors, attendance officers, nursing staff, funding for after-school activities, athletics. It happens differently across the board. It's very, very hard to distinguish and delineate it every single place, but without a doubt, every district has seen and felt this in some way. So in 2010, when this happened, K-12 advocates got to work. Went down to the state house, went to our legislators, said, how can this possibly happen? And at the same time, the governor started to propose changes to the formula that would reduce the weights that students would get with special needs or additional needs. So we were fighting a multifaceted battle here, right? One is protecting the formula, the other one is protecting the funding. Consistently, there's been more success in protecting the formula, and there's been less success in protecting the funding and getting additional funding. The governor does talk about the fact that the state is investing record amount of money in K-12 education. And to some extent, that's true because the dollar amount is going up. That doesn't mean that the percentage that we're getting closer to fulfilling what the school formula says we should have, and we've lost a lot of federal money and other grants in addition to that. So it's one thing to say I'm putting more money in this than I ever have, and it's another thing to say, are we meeting our obligation? Are we fulfilling our needs to our students? Never mind following the law. So in 2010, 2011, New Jersey Working Families, which is where I'm at, has a coalition called Better Choices, which is a budget-focused campaign, and we became very engaged in advocating for K-12 funding and protecting it. It was at that point where I was functioning as a K-12 advocate that something became glaringly obvious to me. I could go in and advocate for school funding, and the legislators would even tell me, I agree with you, we should be funding the schools more. Where would you like me to take the money from? Should it come from affordable housing? Healthcare? Where would you suggest I take it from? Because I've got no money in this budget. And so I was led down a path, not a very uplifting one, I admit, to understanding the budget in its entirety. But what I began to realize was that we could not effectively advocate for K through 12 funding unless we participated in the broader discussion of the budget in the state of New Jersey. Evidently, I said that a lot, because this year I was asked to take over the Better Choices campaign. You got to be careful what you talk about. And so I work now across the spectrum of areas of budget. And one of the things that I find that is most important in effective K through 12 advocacy is this idea of functioning within the entire budget and understanding it. Because our legislators are not perfect, but are almost as frustrated as we are. And we need to give them tools and means to move forward, to find solutions, which they're not naturally inclined to do. I don't mean that too judgmentally, but there's a certain lethargy in legislatures. So right now, currently, New Jersey is 48th in the country in economic recovery. Our unemployment rates remain high. We have nationally, across the nation, we have record high corporate subsidies, right, which result in less revenue every year as we give additional tax credits to large corporations. Those are revenues that are not going into school funding, for example. We have a millionaire's tax that was upon the richest people of the state, earning, I think, $450,000 and more, that expired in 2010, which cost us nearly $1 billion in revenues, and we have no appetite in the government to reinstate it. There is an overall lack of appetite to do anything to increase revenues across the board. So if we want to effectively protect school funding and advocate for school funding, we have to talk about things like the Transportation Trust Fund. And this is where I lose a lot of education advocates. You want me to talk about the Transportation Trust Fund? And I go, well, yeah, I do, because it's almost broke. And when it goes broke, we not only will we not fund road projects and repair our roads, but the debt that we owe on the Transportation Trust Fund will need to be paid, and that will come out of our general revenue fund, which is where we get education funding from. Now, it's bad enough we're not following the law to fund education, but when we stop paying our debt, we get in real trouble, like with credit ratings and agencies, and we lose our borrowing ability. So you can bet your bottom dollar, and they're going to reach for it too, that you're going to pay the Transportation Trust Fund out of the general fund before you're going to fund education. So if we want to be part of the solution for K through 12 education, we have to be part of the solution for the Transportation Trust Fund. And there may be some other things along the way. I'm just using that as one example. Because when we stabilize that, we have the opportunity to go in and say, okay, now let's talk about education funding. If we refuse to participate in the discussions for those solutions, we continue the cycle of asking for what can't be given and causing frustration. The one thing I know is that we have an effective formula that is the goal we should be working towards. And while I work with advocates who simply go, well, it's the law, why aren't we funding it? And they're right. They're not wrong in saying that. The reality is we're not going to get to fund it overnight. We're probably not going to get to fund it in the next 2 to 5 years. But if we work together to a reasonable goal and say, let's try to work there in 5 years, or in 5 years, this is how much closer we'd like to be, and these are the means and the tools by which we'd like to get there and be part of the broader solution, then we can all come together to be effective. And when we work across areas of the budget, and we ally ourselves with the people who are fighting to solve the Transportation Trust Fund, the nice thing is they'll come back and support us in our fight for education. Because right now we're all fighting for parts of a diminishing pie, right? And sooner or later we're going to stall ourselves out fighting over those pieces, but if we come together and we work together in it, and that includes people who work in incarceration issues, in healthcare issues, in transportation issues, united we can push the government in a direction where everybody is going to benefit, and we should start to see the economic growth and the development we want. So that's education funding in very brief synopsis, and also why it's not just about education, but it's about issues beyond that that need to be part of our vision when we want to fix what's wrong with education. Thank you.
Thank you for that. That was really very informative. So I'm Chris McGoy, and I'm from Montclair, New Jersey. And I just wanted to say, you know, there's this broader landscape in what's happening with schools, which is determining what is happening to every child now today. Mm-hmm. And I would say, from my point of view, that we are losing control of our schools. We no longer have a say in what our children are being taught to the degree we did before. Issues are being taken out of our hands. And why is this? You know, it's not a mystery. There are two pieces of legislation that I think everybody should know about. So in 2002, you probably have heard of No Child Left Behind. Yeah, we're good? Yeah?
I'm sorry for interrupting.
That's okay. So you probably have heard of the No Child Left Behind Act. And No Child Left Behind had just a few pieces. I'm going to speak in a very broad brush, right? Under No Child Left Behind, every state had to develop standards. And then those standards were going to be tested, the children would be tested, data would be generated from those tests, and then certain sanctions would be levied against schools. So No Child Left Behind came to be known as Test and Punish. And the sanctions levied against the schools could be everything from, you know, an intervention to have remediation and just to fill certain achievement gaps to actually a taking of the school. And there were even percentages of how many schools could fall to the bottom of your portfolio every year and be under stress. The No Child Left Behind law said that by 2014, 100% of the children in all of the schools had to be proficient. This was not an achievable goal. I mean, if one kid throws up on testing day, you're killed, you know. You don't have 100% of the kids. So, you know, for many years, educators struggled with this. And we're hoping for relief. The law was not generating the kind of changes anybody would think. We kept to the standards, kept teaching kids, kept testing kids. By 2012, Massachusetts, which is often considered the best education state, you know, except this year it's New Jersey, Massachusetts had 80% of its schools under some form of sanction or another. Right, Massachusetts. So you can see how this scheme was not really reflecting what was going on in schools and was starting to drive a very unhealthy school atmosphere. When President Obama was elected, many people, including me, were very hopeful that the stringent No Child Left Behind would be changed in the legislature, you know, in Congress. That didn't happen. What did happen instead is that our Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, said, well, I'm going to give you waivers from No Child Left Behind if you do a couple things for me and attach some money to them. That's a race to the top. And the things I'm going to do, you know, I'll give you the money, but this is what you have to sign on to. And you can read this. And I have a handout, and you can go to your home or your computer and click on it and read it. And the first thing you have to do is you have to sign up for the Common Core, right? And when Race to the Top was first issued, a lot of the states signed on before ever seeing Common Core because it wasn't done. So you have to sign on to the Common Core standards, number one. You have to, of course, then have a test that relates to the Common Core standards, and that here in New Jersey is going to be the PARC, right? And then that test is going to generate data, just like No Child Left Behind. But guess what? This time what we're going to do with that data, we are going to evaluate your teachers with it and your principals with it, and if they don't meet their achievement marks, we're going to get rid of them. We're going to fire them. And you have to create a method within your state. Every state kind of approaches slightly differently to evaluate your teachers according to the kid test scores, right? So here in New Jersey, this last year was 30%, and now we're going to go 10%, 20%, 30% of a teacher's evaluation will come from how her kids do or his kids do on the PARC test, right? And I know when I used to take my kids grocery shopping when they were little, and one of them would have a bad day and start screaming, and everybody would look at me like I was the worst mother in the world. You know, if anybody judged me on my kid's behavior that day, I would be in trouble. So, and I just want to say there are a lot of concerns. Statistical analysts have looked at these measures. They're called VAM. Here we call student growth objective. They are very problematical, and we have great bloggers and writers here, Bruce Baker, School Finance 101, Jersey Jasmine, you can read about it. They're very shaky. The evaluation is very shaky. Anyway, okay, so then the other thing we can do is you know, we can come in and we can take your school. And Race to the Top also said there's no caps on charter schools anymore. And Race to the Top said, and you have to keep this data stream that's going to follow the kids forever, right? You're going to keep a data stream on your children. And if you read what it says, Race to the Top, you have to have in a state a longitudinal data system. You have to have that. And we encourage you to have a horizontal data system, which means collect every piece of data you can and put it in. There's a lot of confusion about what data is being collected. I know up here in Ridgewood, you're going to have a whole nother symposium on student privacy and that data in December. So this is the framework now. So the kids in school right now, how we're having Common Core, it's because someone signed on to Common Core, right? And all you had to do to sign on to Common Core is your Department of Education head and your governor had to sign on to it. There was no discussion beforehand. There was no everybody looking at it. Let's all get together and decide how this is going to work. Let's get our boards of education and our superintendents and everybody and all our teachers. That didn't happen. So why is this so important? Because what's happening in education today is that a small group of people are deciding what is good for our children, how they want things to move. And they're deciding, what they believe is that it's test and punish. Or maybe they don't believe that. Maybe this is just a scheme, right? A scheme that drives everything. So I just want to talk about two words. Oligarchy, I'm gonna talk about oligarchy and democracy, and equity. And I don't wanna get into a debate about what the standards are or what they say. People have many different opinions on that. So I don't wanna debate that, but I wanna talk about the development of the Common Core standards in light of those two words. So the Common Core standards, when they were developed, here's what happened. This guy, David Coleman, went with one of the chief state school officers to Bill Gates, and they said, you know what we'd like to do? We would like to develop this common set of standards, and we need somebody to pay for them. And Bill Gates said, okay, I'll pay for them. And so they decided that they were going to do this totally off the books, totally outside of government. Now, why would you have to do that? Because the federal government, by law, cannot write standards. That's supposed to be left to the states. Education's supposed to be left to the states. So they said, this is how we'll get around it. And I call it off the books, you know, or you might call it like dark education, like they say dark money, you know. So they got together, nobody really knows because it was a big secret, 26, 27 people together to write the standards. And the articles that I give you have all this in there. There were really no teachers in there. Maybe two of them had a little high school experience. Everybody was otherwise connected to a testing company, a data company. And they wrote what they thought were good standards. And they wrote the standards this way. Here's where we want the kids to end up in high school. We'll just kind of chunk them all the way down. So when they released the first draft of the standards, the childhood development specialists went out of their minds. They said, this is not physically appropriate for children. This is not developmentally appropriate for children. And they began to, 500 of the best childhood development specialists wrote a letter at the time, and nobody listened. And what happened instead of that was that these standards were then floated by larger bodies, and they got to sign off. Teachers got to blob in comments, never heard back what happened. And I think you know, because you had Sandra Stotsky up here, that the only two content experts for the standards, Sandra Stotsky and James Milgram, refused to sign off on them because they didn't like them, right? But now we're stuck with these standards. We're stuck with them. But because they were scalable, right, you could bring them to scale. You could make everything the same in every school across the country, that kids would be learning at the same rate, right? And this is the big word in education now. Can we bring it to scale? And equity, right? Equity is supposed to mean sameness. It's supposed to mean the same. We're on the same page at the same time doing the same standard to the same test. And how attractive is that to someone like Bill Gates? So how are we going to do this? We're going to test online. We're going to keep the data online. Everybody's going to have a Chromebook. You know, the materials are all going to be generated by Pearson. So we suddenly have, and when you can go online and watch Bill Gates say, the opening of markets. Never before have we had such a market in education. And I believe that what has happened is that this huge financial market, and this is how they talk about it, that education has become a huge financial market. Now, now you're bound, and so you can see how this oligarchy, right, influences. You can follow the money. Bill Gates himself, $2.3 billion has been sent to advertise the Common Core, place writing in the country, have groups to promote it, push it through teachers. Every time you turn around, you're hearing how fabulous this is, right? But it really has not undergone any examination by the public. I think we're starting to have trouble with it because it was never field tested. But if you go to your school board and say, "But you know what? This isn't working for me. What can your school board do?" It's signed on by the state. It's signed, sealed, and delivered. So this is the context that we're facing in education now, you know, and we're facing the loss of our schools. I live in Montclair. Newark is just down Bloomfield Avenue from us, right? And Newark is marching down Bloomfield Avenue to Montclair. All of the people, all the reformers who work in Newark, they live in Montclair. People now who have been working in Newark, the PR representative for Cami Anderson, who shut down communications with the people of Newark, guess where he works now? In Montclair. We can't ask a question at a school board meeting. We do not get an answer. So what I want to close with is to say, we're in a framework where decision-making has been taken out of our hands. In this, we are all the same. If the people in Newark have no voice and their schools were taken long before, you know, race to the top, but if the people in Newark have no voice, if they have no local control, I want you to remember that you are rapidly moving into the same position. And I know that your local school boards want to be responsive, but their hands are tied too. So I urge you, it is time to get involved in the educational discussion, to understand that legislation must be changed, that government must be made, you know, to play its appropriate role, that local control has to come back. And I will close with reading you a very short bit. When I read it, I almost fell off my chair. I was driving in the car one day, I heard this on the radio on NPR, and I printed off the article. So in Kenya, there is a private school company that runs academies, Bridge International Academies. And they've set up over 200 schools in Kenya over the past 4 years. So let me read you this and see if it sounds like your schools now. To accomplish this, Bridge has set up a highly structured, technology-driven model that relies on teachers reading standardized lessons from handheld computers. The e-reader not only delivers the lesson script to the teachers, but it also acts as an electronic timesheet, gradebook, and supervisor. The tablet tracks what time the teacher arrives, what time she leaves, and how long she spends on every lesson. The administrative side of the school can be run off a smartphone. The exact same lesson being taught in this classroom is being taught in every other sixth grade class at Bridge schools across the country, says Bridge co-founder Shannon May. If you were at one of the other 200 locations right now, you'd be seeing the exact same thing, she says. In some ways, it is kind of the magic in it. That magic of standardized lesson plans changes the role of the teacher. It allows Bridge to hold down costs because it can hire teachers who don't have college degrees, TFA. Teachers are not content producers any longer, says May of Bridge Schools. So when we talk about equity in schools, we're talking about the children, we're talking about the teachers, we're talking about the administrators. So please get involved. You've got your great Ridgewood Cares About Schools, and let's hear what they have to say.
So, wow, there's not much to say after that, Chris. So I come to the conversation of school reform as a high school principal in New York City. I run the largest transfer high school, which is an alternative school, means that my students have been in other high schools and have not experienced success. They're between the ages of 17 and 21. And they, I was calculating it today, this year at this moment, I have somewhere between 85 and 90% of my students who are entitled to free or reduced lunch. They have missed a tremendous amount of education for a variety of reasons. Some kids have been incarcerated. Some kids are parents. We have a daycare center in the school, school-based health clinic. We try to provide just about everything that we can, including sound education. So New York City had the privilege of being at the forefront of the school reform movement in the United States. We had Mayor Bloomberg, who was also a big funder of school reform, and his favorite chancellor, Chancellor Klein, Joel Klein, who also now works for Rupert Murdoch and Amplify, selling some really great instructional tools and data collection tools for us all. So high stakes accountability is something that I'm very familiar with, and I used to worry a lot about. We had No Child Left Behind, and we had very strict performance targets. And as you can imagine, kids who are not really interested in school don't do well on tests. So my test, my data, when you look at it, the attendance, test scores, it's in the toilet. And it has been. I'm very honest about that. Somebody told me a very long time ago, that's your data, own it. Don't apologize for it. That's what it is. So it's bad. But my teachers work very hard. I work very hard. Our students work extremely hard. And have been up against some educational failure that I would have turned away from if I were them. So we had No Child Left Behind sanctions that we had to face. We had something called school report cards. That was also another way that we could punish schools in New York City. And the school report card really looked at the same data that was collected for No Child Left Behind. But it just kind of ratcheted it up a level by comparing you to peer schools. So luckily for me, we do well compared to our peer schools. So my school was able to every year kind of squeak by and not get threatened with closure. But what I did get to see was what happens to schools when they're closed. When students who really love their teachers and the teachers who love their students and who are trying very hard under some extremely difficult circumstances are told, you may no longer go to this school, you have to leave and go someplace else. I've sat at hearings and watched the children beg for their schools, and the begging and the tears and the videos and the pleading just falls on deaf ears. So that to me is what they call structural violence, where we have created a system that punishes the people who suffer the most. And it's a really horrific thing to have to watch. So I struggle, the last thing I want is for my school to close. It's been open as an alternative high school now for 42 years. And we like to refer to it as a port in the storm. It's a place where kids can come and get some refuge in a city that's not always kind to them, where they can get an education and hopefully get to go to college. So I had to make a choice as a principal. Do I do what I know pedagogically or instructionally is the right thing to do, the really great teaching, or do we do that kind of data analysis, item analysis of the tests that we're being held accountable to, and do we teach to the test? So I'm going to own it and say it publicly. I chose to teach to the test, and actually that's why my school is probably still open to this day, because we do teach to the test. We analyze the test scores, we focus in on what the discrete skill deficits are, we make sure that the kids can pass the test the next time it's given, and I'll tell you, my teachers can teach to a test better than probably most teachers on the planet. Because our survival depends on it, and we need to do it for the kids, and we need to keep the school open. But in the big picture, what I was hearing was my students were coming home from college after their first year and saying, you know, Jean, it didn't really work out, yeah, I'm coming home. And so I knew that what we were doing was not right. And I really was starting to lose sleep about it. So I thought, I have to start speaking up, and I have to start speaking out. So I learned from a group of folks. We went to Washington, D.C. one spring to go sit outside of Arne Duncan's office and tell him what we thought about school reform. And they said, the folks I was with, You know, if they don't have the testing data, this whole system that they have of accountability falls apart. So I thought, oh, so if I don't have my kids tested, then they can't use the data to hurt children ultimately and close their schools. So the first year I opted out, I wasn't really concerned about my own children at that point, because I thought, you know, we live in this nice tree-lined streets of Ridgewood, and we pay a lot of taxes, and our school system's really good. And I thought, oh, this isn't going to get to Ridgewood, but I need to speak out for my students. So I opted my kids out. And then I was noticing that the conversation in Ridgewood was changing. And we're talking about the Common Core, and then we're talking about the New Jersey Ask, but then the park, and I'm paying more attention now to who's publishing the homework that's coming home, what is looking like test prep, and I'm noticing that we're doing a lot of teaching to the test in Ridgewood too. And I know that test scores in Ridgewood, if they drop, our property values drop too. So there's some stakes that I thought maybe didn't exist here that do exist here. So I thought, all right, so as Junius teaches us, if you just do it by yourself, nobody's paying you any attention. So what you have to do is get people organized and come as a group and do it together. So I've worked with folks across the state of New Jersey to organize parents to deny the state our testing data. Because if they can't count it, they can't use it against us. So that's one piece. The other piece that I've learned during these years is that there's plenty of data to be collected that can tell a different narrative. So at my own school, I have what we call an alternative data system, and we've taught other alternative high schools to do the same thing, where we collect the same data that the Department of Education collects about our schools, but we analyze it differently, and we can tell a very different story. They can tell us a failure story with weighting kids. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors that they use when they do these school report cards. But if we just look at straight up how many kids passed, how many kids failed, who's graduating, who's not, who's moving forward, we can tell some really great stories of success. So what I have to say to us all is that we really do have more power. Sometimes it feels like, how can we fight this big system? What can we do? We have a lot of power, but we have to realize that we have it, and we have to work together. And we especially have to amplify each other's voices. So one last thing, I had to work for Cami Anderson, was my direct supervisor. And I'm usually like a peaceful, loving kind of person, but I have such anger toward that woman for what she did to the alternative high schools in New York City. She really destroyed our superintendency. We're just now beginning to build it back. We have, for the first time since she left to go to Newark, we have a superintendent this year, and I'm very hopeful that with the new mayor, de Blasio, that we'll be able to build something really positive back. But my heart goes out to the folks in Newark, because I know from experience what she's doing to them. It's wrong. We need to pay attention. We need to document. We need to tell the story, because she shouldn't be sleeping at night. So, thanks.
Thank you all very, very much. Before we open it up to questions, and before Junius makes some remarks, I just wanted to see if any of the panelists had anything else they wanted to add based on what others have said.
One aspect of the finances of it is that as we have the high-stakes testing and you have a curtailment or a staling of the funding of schools, you're increasing the percentage of the funding that's going towards the tests, the Common Core purchase curriculum, the equipment necessary for the tests, the broadband necessary for the tests. And so it is a synergy, a particularly destructive synergy that's happening, because you have limited funds to begin with that don't even fulfill the basic needs that you're supposed to be funded for. And then you're also being told, but by the way, if you don't succeed in this one particular area, you could get taken over, you could get closed and everything else. So the impact of these policies and the way they play with the finances is exponentially more destructive than one or the other on their own.
And I just wanted to add that, you know, we have been sold the idea of this Common Core and the testing to make everything the same, right, to create equality. But I wanted to say that in the states where the testing has already gone forward, so you can look in New York, you can look in Kentucky, you can look in Colorado where reports have been coming out, everybody fails. You know, 70% of the kids fail, but who it hits more hardly, it hits our kids who are in the opportunity gap. So, and there's a lot of writing on this. I just wanted to just to let you hear, Carol Burris and Alan Aja, her co-worker from New York. Carol's an award-winning high school principal. You may have written many of her, read her posts on the answer sheet via Valerie Strauss in the Washington Post. Anyway, she says, the below standard on CCS third grade English language arts was went from 15.5% to 50% under Common Core. These are for kids in the opportunity gap. And in seventh grade math, they had been at 16.5 to 70%, right? So the people that we're pretending we're gonna help the most are getting hurt the worst. And I am concerned, and many writers are starting to say, we're beginning to see, if this continues, a ranking and sorting out of society across the board, yes. Which helps nobody, right? And one last point, Moody's, I just read a report from Moody's saying that in Los Angeles, where there are many charter schools, the districts are being downgraded their bond ratings because the charter schools are failing to provide the education that's required, and of course then all that money is lost and it downgrades the whole school system.
I accepted this assignment gladly because, you see, I used to be a trial lawyer, and trial lawyers have to sum up to the jury at some point. And you don't have a script. I mean, it's like jazz improvisation. But sometimes if you have a losing case, you really are scrambling for something to tell the jury. And sometimes it's just best to just be quiet and to submit. But in this case, I think our proponents for justice here have given me a great deal of material to work with. So I want you to kind of hold on here, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, because all you have to do is to connect the dots. Sharon Smith told us about One Newark. And One Newark is a plan anchored under this concept of choice, where all the choices are being made by somebody else for somebody. Let me give you an example. Why would me as a parent or as a student want to transfer from one failing school in my neighborhood to a failing school 2.5 miles away? That's the kind of choice that the students and the parents have in Newark. Now, that choice comes with some real problems. Some of you may have seen the mayor's effort to bring attention to this, Mayor Baraka in Newark, when he went over to Barringer High School. Based on some video footage that my students did to show, for example, that there were 50 and 60 kids in a class at Barringer High School, that there were no seats for many of them, and for 80 minutes at a time, they either had to sit on the floor, stand up, or sit in the window sills, where there were kids who were Spanish speaking in classes where their only teachers spoke English. These conditions continue to exist today. That the class size may have been adjusted. There are no more classes, 50, 60, 70. Oh, hoorah. They've been brought down to, guess what, 35 to 40. And that's supposed to be progress. So you've got a horrendous churn going on in the school district in Newark for teachers, for parents, and for students. Now, the second aspect of this connection that I want you to see is what's happening with the money. What we learn next from Deborah is you follow the money, you see what's happening in another level with the schools. I think the number that she told us was that over since 2010, $6 billion, we are $6 billion in the hole based upon the SRA, not the Abbott decision, which was killed in 2008 by a Democratic governor, I might add. The SFRA, let's just use that formula, $6 billion in the hole statewide. So is it any wonder that in a city like Newark, you don't have enough teachers to teach in the classes, that you do have classes that are 35 and 40. You don't have the social workers to help the children who come to school with the issues that Jean talked about, that there's nothing in school to make the school interesting for the kids to want to pass the test. I had a principal say to me sometime during this intervening period, where he was in a school where there were 37% of the kids were special ed. 37%, that's one third of the kids were special ed. By law, they're supposed to have extra. They did not have extra. He said, I go to bed at night thinking that what can I do to make this school interesting for these kids, because I just don't have it. He cared, and next year, of course, he was gone. Another symptom, continual churn and turnover of teachers and principals. Teachers put in something called a pool, teacher without assignment, where somebody said, well, that's not a good teacher. Some of those teachers aren't good, but there's a process to weed them out. But some of them just spoke out and said, I wonder why they're taking away auto mechanics from Eastside High School. I wonder why the cooking program, they don't have food for the kids to cook. So what we don't have focused upon in one Newark is the fact that slowly but surely the resources necessary for urban education is being drained, not just from Newark, but all over the state. But at the same time, there's another level I search for the word, there's another level of obvious pain that's being visited upon these kids and their parents, and that's this whole question of Park and the test. Because see, ultimately, these kids who are in schools that don't have the equipment that they need, who don't have the teachers who they need, who don't have the social workers that they need, they have to take that test. And if they don't pass the test, there are consequences. Now, it doesn't take too much to understand that somebody is up here who understands that we have an impossibility that has been aligned for our urban schools. They know these kids will not pass the test. They know, therefore, that the penalties can then be put into place, ending up with them taking the school and giving it to another charter school, or whatever other kinds of resources that are in that school. For example, you got people now buying schools in Newark, turning from public ownership to absolute private ownership. Because you now have a resource that's been built up throughout the years. You say, well, the school's bad and it's old. Nothing good can come from that school. Well, there are two sets of money, two piles of money, if you will, two sources of money available in the state of New Jersey. One is the Abbott money, which our governor has said, we're not going to spend that money. Why? Well, he just doesn't want to spend it. Every now and then he trickles out something. Hope y'all remember that. He trickles out a little building one here and there, and he goes and stands out and gets the credit for doing the school. But Newark is supposed to, for example, have 10 new schools built. No, it's only three been built under that Abbott money. In the meantime, the charter schools, which have said, well, we can take over these schools, all these old schools, the schools that are not being properly maintained or not adequately maintained because there's no money, we can use some of the federal money that's available and rehabilitate those schools. And guess what? That same rehabilitation money was available and is available to the public schools, but not $1 of it has been allowed to go to the public schools. $127 million has gone since 2008, I believe, to two charter school networks in Newark. Money that could have gone into the public schools for those same buildings. So finally, you see that there's a vicious cycle here. You've got something that's called choice, but the choice is not being made. You've got a diminishing set of returns coming from the school districts, and the children are put into a position where they can never prove the point that they are successful because the test is dependent upon them having well-funded, well-resourced, happy professional teachers and principals working with them and for them. So if you think there's a conspiracy going on, I think you're right. Pass the word on. Now, what can be done? Well, Jean is working it both ways. She's saying, well, we're going to teach them to pass the test. But I would suggest that it requires a principal and a relatively stable staff in order to do that. We don't have that in Newark. We don't have that kind of stability. Even the best, well-minded person who wants to teach in Newark understands you coming into a situation where if you even open your mouth, you could be gone. Mm-hmm. If you complain one iota, you could be gone. So you don't have that possibility in Newark and in some of the other places, I would imagine, but especially in Newark because we're under Cammie Anderson. So what else is a possibility? Well, Gene says, well, we need to withdraw enthusiasm from the test itself. That is a possibility. But I come back to the age-old possibility that I talk about in my book and I talk about in my classes and which has been my life, and that is the people must come together, organize, and take back their school district. I don't remember exactly which one of our panelists said it, but I think they all alluded to it. And if we all stick together, that can be made possible. That voice can be amplified, the parent voice that's crying out in Newark, in places in New York, in Montclair. This is the voice that we need your help with. How can you help? We have a governor right now who's running for president. We have a governor who's running for president. You get my point? You all who vote for him in Ridgewood, he needs to hear from you. He needs to know that you know what's going on in this particular situation. He needs to hear from more and more Ridgewoods all around the state so that you can see that cycle, that craziness, starting with the one Newark and the so-called choice with the diminished resources and the imposition of the test that the kids can't possibly pass so that the thing just continues to privatize. It's in your interest that we do this as well as ours. Why? Because a thriving, vibrant economy means less of a problem in other areas for you. We don't have to pay for prisons where you're paying $50,000, $40,000 a person to keep a prison open, when all we want in the school districts is 25 or 30. Not even that. I don't know how much you pay for education per person in the Ridgewoods. Not that. How much do you pay?
14.
So you see the difference between 14 and 50 to keep a prison bed open. You're paying for both of those. Why should there be one and not the other? So we need the resources, but more importantly, we need your voices to come to the table on behalf of the folks who are south of Ridgewood. Thank you very much.
So what I'll say is that if you think they want to close schools, can you imagine what they want to do to places where they prepare teachers? We're really in trouble. We're going to open it up for some questions now from the audience.
Thank you for your time. I have two questions. An obvious, a very obvious question is the for Sharon and for Deborah. The schools in Newark are run by the state, correct?
Correct.
Okay, Cami Anderson works for the state of New Jersey. Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. I thought so. Pardon me for my ignorance. Do you know what the per student funding is for Newark students? Is it 20?
It's about 19,000.
Okay.
I want to slightly expand on that, because when you hear that number, there's two things that are really important. The first is that doesn't translate to how much money the students are actually getting. Charter schools get 90% per pupil when they get funded. So they're getting 90% per pupil of that 19,000. But when you look at elementary school budgets, the actual budgets that the actual elementary schools are getting in Newark, you'll find that per pupil they're getting about $8,000. Because the rest is going to Cami's overhead, very high administrative costs. So a lot of the money doesn't actually make it to the student, and disproportionately high amount of it in Newark doesn't make it to the student in the school.
The funding for your schools comes from the state of New Jersey, and a large portion of that comes from Bergen County, statistically speaking. So is there a... Pardon me?
And from property taxes.
Yes, exactly. Property taxes and state income tax as well. Is there a parent PTA or Board of Education, a PTA in Newark that is active?
Yes, there are PTAs that are active, but our superintendent has pushed for the PTAs to be converted to PTOs, where there's less restriction, less accountability to monies, and a lot of the principals actually ask those parent groups for money for certain events in the school, and so the money is turned around through the parents, and monies are not given to, or the monies that are raised by the PTO are not used specifically for students or parents' events. It's actually events that the school wants to hold for the parents and claim that they don't have money for it, and so then the parent ends up paying for those events. So initially, we did have a lot of PTAs in Newark, a lot of them which were not active because of the lack of parents participating in them. And so when Cami Anderson became superintendent, that's when it was a change in promoting PTO instead of PTA.
Is it more active? Is it a larger group now?
No, not really, because most of the parents are discouraged somewhat. And so most of the time, PTAs have a voice in the school, but lately there is no voice in the school, out of the school. And so there's activities. So like one parent told me they were giving an ice cream special, something like that. But in regards to training parents to understand how to build their school, how to make it a better school, those type of trainings are no longer available. When I was listening to Chris earlier when she was talking about Bill Gates, right? And I can remember being a part of the minority leaders for the PTA, and we had an event where Bill Gates, I don't know if she was a CEO, but she came to the state PTA to ensure that we were going to promote Common Core, and we had to vote on it at the PTA, and PTA became a tool to push for the Common Core, and they were fighting to get each state to join in, and that's really how the Common Core was pushed through the PTA initially. So the parents and the teachers got together and actually pushed for the Common Core.
I wanted to add really quickly, this is happening across the state with the PTAs, that they're increasingly being asked to fund through independent fundraising for the school's fundamental parts of curriculum necessities. In particular, they're being asked to supplement technology, creating tech labs,
buying keyboards, which is facilitating the administration of these high-stake tests. And you're right, because there's a very vicious circle here, but it is a point at which parents have to say, this is how much I pay for property taxes, this is how much my school should be getting from the state, and on top of that, you're telling me as a PTA to go raise $20,000 for the technology to administer a test that I don't want my child to take? Like, there has to be a point at which the PTAs are willing to get engaged and speak up and say no.
Can I just make one more comment? And perhaps it is upon our due diligence as taxpayers in this state to let our governor know that we are fed up with the waste, fraud, and abuse that goes on in schools across the state, specifically like Newark. I mean, how can you get that kind of money and not be funded?
How involved are the superintendents in working together against this core curriculum? I mean, it seemed to me that these organizations should be working with superintendents as well, because if we really want to make a difference, it's superintendents who are pushing this core curriculum and enhancing the standards that are expected of children and the demands made on teachers. So why aren't we using some advocacy against them or with them?
In New Jersey, our superintendents just had their salaries capped not too long ago. So I think there's a lot of fear on the parts of superintendents to speak out and as strongly as they might. I know our superintendent in Ridgewood has done some speaking out, not as much as, of course, as I would like him to, but he's done some speaking out against teacher evaluation and the use of the test scores. But in New York State, superintendents in the Lower Hudson Valley are absolutely getting together, and they're not afraid, and they're speaking out very loudly and very clearly, and there are superintendents across the country doing the same. John Kuhn just wrote a book in Texas about the testing miracle that really sent us down this road that was a fraud. And so, yeah, so superintendents are speaking out, but it is, you know, you're putting your job on the line, and it's a risk, so you have to be courageous.
I just want to add that I don't know if you know where Bloomfield is. It's a suburb over from Montclair. And we are beginning to see in New Jersey superintendents who are saying enough and who are starting to speak out. And in Bloomfield, the superintendent and the Board of Education has said, well, you know, we're bound by law to do these things. But what we're going to do is tell our parents we don't believe in them. We don't believe in testing. They organize parents to write to Congress. To urge Congress to change legislation, and they can't tell parents to opt out, but they are giving them all the information they need to do it. And I think this is so important. People like Jean, superintendents, educators, the people who are in the schools, and you see this in New York, you see it that it happened in New York, are able to talk about what's happening in the schools and connect with parents from the outside, and together that's a very powerful force, you know, for change, because as parents, we listen to the teacher, we listen to the principal, and even when we sense that something's wrong with curriculum, if your superintendent is telling you, oh, it's great, oh, the kids can do it, they're going to love, oh, we're all going to do great on the part, you know, you're really low, you know, you're slow to question it. The other thing I would say is take the park, you can take it online, and then that starts a lot of discussion in your community. We just did it in Montclair, and people were floored, changed a lot of opinions. Yes, there are sample tests online that you can go to and take, and you can get groups of people together to take them and have conversation, and it really well, you can have your kid take the sample test, too.
I want to add one thing to the question about the superintendent and the 2% cap is really important, because it's not just that they've become scared. It's that a lot of experienced veteran superintendents have left their jobs. When their contracts were up and they were faced with a huge pay loss or going across to Connecticut or Pennsylvania or retiring, they left. And so what you're doing is you're replacing them with a cadre many of times trained in this whole notion of school reform out of what we call the Broad School. They're trained to administer this. So the 2% cap creates fear, and it creates the turnover. So it's connecting the dots that Junius is talking about. It's part of the way to destabilize the system, to replace it with the cogs in the wheel that will administer your agenda. Not to be too blunt about it.
I'm a retired teacher. I retired in 2008. I did see how No Child Left Behind affected my students. I still have teacher friends who are working, and I hear horror stories all the time. I wish that this had been televised or recorded, because I'd love to take this. I'm the president of the Passaic County Retired Educators. I would love to present all this material to them. I'm also a member of the League of Women Voters. I'd love to present this material to them. Is there any way I can get kind of a synopsis of what you've done? Have you ever thought of doing that? Thank you, and thank you very much.
And if you ask, I'll volunteer myself to either the NJREA or to the League of Women Voters to come speak on this.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll come.
I have a funding question, and it's more about accountabilities for each of the school districts. I live in Bergen County. I live in one of the sparkly districts around here. We're very small. We're a K-8 district. And one of the things that I have been trying to figure out through advertised budgets over the last several years is exactly what we have spent in textbooks, in new professional development, in equipment, in pretty much everything related. I cannot get a straight answer out. Has the state of New Jersey done any kind of an audit to find out what that would be? And then per what you were saying about the PTAs and PTOs possibly raising money, where I am, it's an education association. And in my tiny little town, we're raising over $100,000 a year. That's parents just giving in extra money on top of our taxes. And those things are going to pay for computers so that the district is ready for PARC. But what I want to know is, does the state of New Jersey care? Is that going to be part of an audit ever? Or do I have to stand up in front of my Board of Ed and be the person with the target on my forehead saying, tell us how much you spent?
The quick answer to that in our experience is that the you're the one with the target on your forehead. Okay, that's the quick answer. The state sent out a survey to ask for PARC readiness. Now, catch 22 here, the districts don't want to tell them they're not ready because it makes them look like targets. It puts targets on their forehead. So most districts will embellish their readiness or be optimistic about it. It's very hard to distinguish how much they're spending for PARC preparedness, and because it's also tied to how much they're spending for Common Core, and that's been embedded in their budget for some time. You have to ask really specific questions, which I'm happy to help with crafting. There's some information that's going to be going up on a Facebook page called Parents Not for Profit, which will be providing toolkits and asking these specific questions. It takes really a good board member to give you that information, to sit down with you, or a good BA, right, who's willing to share that. Because they'll have a technology line, and they'll say, well, but not all of it's for PARC, right? But suddenly that technology line doubles, right? And then the other thing you have to do is actually look at the audited spending versus what they're projecting, because they'll often make it look one way and then be forced to spend it another way. So it's very hard to get these answers. We have asked and surveyed some districts through various studies last year at the early stages. My district estimated it spent $700,000 last year on PARC preparedness, which is not nearly what they're going to end up spending. Some districts have estimated about $1 million within a year. So it depends. Now remember, though, those are districts which actually had that money to move around. When you go to a financially strangled district like an urban district, they're not investing that money, which feeds this hypocrisy that we're actually about trying to help the kids who have less opportunity, because we're testing their computer literacy through PARC, but we're not giving them computers in the classrooms or access to computers absent the test taking.
And we're not teaching the teachers how to use the computers that are there, and you don't have the access to the web in most of these places, and you don't, I'm talking about the urban communities, and you don't have enough computers to go around. So but specifically to answer your question, we teach people how to analyze budgets from time to time. I would suggest, and there's a woman in Patterson whose name I can't think of. She just retired. Irene Sterling just retired from the Patterson Education Fund. And she is an expert on teaching people like you how to analyze the budget. The other thing is, once you figure out the questions and you still have questions, you can OPRA, you can file an OPRA request, Open Public Meetings Act request, and if they don't answer you then you need to go to court. But that's a process for getting it.
I think it was Christine who had mentioned it's really beneficial for superintendents and boards to get on board and fight the effort for PARC and to prepare for PARC. But for districts who districts that don't have superintendents who are that progressive or brave, or don't even have an effort to opt out, districts who are very focused on elite colleges, Bergen Academy acceptances for their children, how would you recommend building some kind of force in those kinds of districts?
You know, Montclair has a Broad superintendent. Everybody knows the Broad Academy, where they teach people who want to be superintendents how to go in and disrupt a district. Like, that is the strategy. You disrupt the district. We just determined that we paid $1.9 million to upgrade our technology, but it wasn't just all for the park. You know, it's for the kids. And our taxes went up 4%. And you know, we've been hoodwinked. And part of the problem, when you can't have a dialogue, right, it's very easy to get anything going. So what we've done is we've begun to organize in town, and we do a lot of informational forums. And now what's starting to happen with the approach of the park is people are having living room meetings and talking. And we're doing a lot of writing. We're doing a lot of letters to the editor. We're doing a lot of organizing, sending to the state. And we're just going in. Who said the target on the forehead? Into board meetings over and over and over again. Now, this has gotten a little bit more than uncomfortable, because with the coming of Kim Anderson's old PR guy to Montclair, his name is Matt Frankel, he searches you out. He finds you on the internet. He starts to bombard you. They have written a sort of nasty blog. Anybody who speaks up, you know, you're attacked on the blog. They put your questions up on the board web. So this stuff can get very, very ugly. But I think what it is, it's joining together. It's joining together. And what we're also seeing in Montclair is the classroom is changing. It's changing. And people are beginning to feel it. And so as the children begin showing harm, the parents are waking up. And that's what's happening to us, because even though our teachers are trying very hard to maintain a good progressive education, right, where you meet the child where the child is and try to bring the child along, that's not how Common Core works, right? Common Core is, you have to be here now, or you're a failure. You are a failure. And you got to perform, or we all go down. So as people are seeing their children hurt, homework change, and as we come up to the park and taking the park test, you know, so I would say those things, and networking with state organizations so that you have that platform, because change is going to have to come locally, right, where you educate each other, you go into your board meetings, you write your letters to the editor, you start talking to your local representatives. It's going to have to come on a state level, you know, and we're going to do something at the federal level. So just begin, and don't give up. And I'm a I just finished being a PTA officer at the school. That's all I talked about on the PTA. I'd walk in the room, people would be like, oh my God, here she comes again, talking about that from the PTA. Let's talk about a fundraiser. No.
Can I don't just, for those elite, the schools you're talking about, here's a couple of things. My son's a junior in high school, my oldest one. They're the guinea pig year for PARC testing. These tests are now going to be given to him with no benchmark set. Potentially go on their permanent record, right? Which means graduate schools could be looking at them. I don't want my son to be part of an experiment, thank you very much. There is no reason that I want him to be. And at the same time that we're instituting this at the K through 12 level, the higher education schools that, you know, your district's trying to send kids to are turning away from standardized tests as a means of judging preparedness for admission. They're recognizing that the standardized test is basically a socioeconomic measure. They already know most kids can't afford their college. They don't need that measure, right? So it's a conundrum, because the higher education people are moving in one direction and the K through 12 are trying to push us in a different direction, and our kids are the guinea pigs. So if you want to get at the heart of the parents in your district, talk to them about the fact that your child is being treated as a commodity to make money off of them, and they're being treated as a guinea pig for an untested form of testing that will go on their permanent record that we don't even know what a passing mark is. The benchmark will be decided a year after they've taken it, but before it's been implemented a second time, which is statistically an egregious error. Right? And this could haunt them. And we don't know for how many years they will be guinea pigs. So is it harmful for my child to take this park test once? Absolutely. Because that could be a permanent part of their record.
All right, sorry we don't have time, but we are going to break now, I guess, the panelists, if you want to ask them part of you. That's fine, but I want to thank everybody for attending this evening. This was a lot of information, very, very good information. And thank you all very much.